We started a series in Proverbs back in January 2018, and we got as far as the end of chapter 5 before we took a very helpful, instructive, and necessary detour through our One Another series and then onto a series on prayer more recently. And tonight we want to pick up again our series in Proverbs. So I hear some of you turning already. You can turn to Proverbs chapter 6. We will get there in a moment. For those of you who don't remember January 2018 so well, let me remind you just briefly of what Doug highlighted in that first service on Proverbs, just as an overview of the book. And we were exposed to some key lessons that we need to have in mind when we come to this book of wisdom literature. We saw that to live a godly life requires us to apply godly wisdom to all of life. We must resolve to seek wisdom so that we can live our lives to the glory of God. And that this is not just a book of moralistic do's and don'ts for life, but rather it offers practical wisdom that enables us to worship God through our lives. A broad outline for this book could be divided into two sections. Probably the first nine chapters 1 to 9, we could look at the invitation to wisdom. And then the remaining chapters, 10 to 31, the implications of wisdom. And so with that as our brief reminder of this book, let us turn our attention tonight to Proverbs chapter 6. And we're just going to be considering the first five verses there, verse 1 to 5, under the heading, Wise Words on Bad Commitments. Wise Words on Bad Commitments. So if you have your Bible in front of me, follow with me as I read these five verses. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, have given your pledge for a stranger, if you are snared in the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself. For you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go, hasten, and plead urgently with your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. If you're taking notes tonight, we're going to be looking at these five verses under three headings. Verse 1 and 2, we'll be considering the scenario or the scene that is laid out before us. Verse 3 and 4, we'll consider the solution. And verse 5, we'll look at a hopeful salvation. But let's look at the first point, the scenario, verse 1 and 2. Solomon has followed a particular pattern in the first five chapters, and we'll see this pattern continue in some of the chapters ahead as well, as he addresses these writings, these instructions on wisdom to his son. But it's not only his son who is the character in these five verses. We see some other characters. In fact, there's three characters that we need to be mindful of in these verses. And there's a particular reason for why these three people are engaging with one another. The purpose of their interaction is with regards to the giving or receiving of money in the form of a loan. So we have one person who is extending a loan to someone. This would be the creditor. We then have a second person who is receiving this loan, and we could refer to him as the borrower. But from the reading of the first verse, we quickly come to realize that the person who was borrowing the money or receiving this loan is not in a financial position to repay this loan and therefore needs someone else to sign surety for the loan. Solomon's son is the one in this scene who is basically co-signing the loan. He is therefore the guarantor of the loan or the one signing the guarantee for the loan. And so what this means is that if the person receiving the loan defaults in his repayment of the loan, the one who guaranteed the loan then becomes liable for that payment. And so these are our three characters. Now, I don't think we should read these words of caution as though Solomon's son is in this dilemma. Notice with me in the opening two verses, we see there it says, "My son, if you have put up." And then again in verse 2, if you are snared in the words of your mouth. It seems like Solomon is presenting a hypothetical situation, but nevertheless, he wants to give his son these words of wisdom to prevent him from falling into such a dilemma. There is also a particular context to the three characters that we have already identified, which is vital to our understanding of this lesson. The creditor in verse 1 is referred to as your neighbor. We will see the same words again in verse 3 as a reference to the creditor. Other translations have used the word brother, companion, or friend as alternate options for neighbor, which points us to the fact that there's some relationship between Solomon's son and the creditor. But what stands in contrast to this is that the loan, what stands in contrast to this known relationship is that the person receiving the loan is referred to in our text as a stranger. A suitable synonym would be foreigner. This tells us that there's not much of a relationship between the person borrowing this money and Solomon's son, and yet he is co-signing a guarantee for his loan. Being a stranger to the son would likely mean that his history of handling finances and possibly even previous debt would be unknown. And so this is the reason for Solomon's teaching. This is why he is giving these words of practical warning to his son. So a couple of points that we should note at this stage. Are these verses teaching us to be stingy with our money? Excuse me. Is Solomon telling his son, don't be a guarantor for somebody else's debt? Is he telling us not to be somebody who loans money out? I don't think he is. What he is calling for is for us as believers and for his son to exercise prudence in these matters. Prudence does not forbid generosity, but it does forbid something that looks more like an act of gambling rather than showing responsibility and good stewardship with what God has given us. Solomon will go on to say in Proverbs 22, verse 3 about prudence, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. A second point to consider is that Solomon is also not teaching us to never lend money or to never sign surety for another person's loan, because God's law has already spoken into these matters. Consider these words in Exodus 22, verse 25 to 27. Moses wrote, "If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest for him. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate." God has given his people instruction here as to how they are to go about lending money and exacting the repayment of that money. What about Leviticus 25? The majority of that chapter is given to speaking about God's people not defrauding one another. It addresses the act of redeeming land for a fellow Israelite who has fallen into poverty, and also as a redeemer for a brother who sells himself into slavery because he is poor. Again, God has already spoken about these principles and about these circumstances. And so, no, he is not forbidding believers from getting involved in these practices. But what Solomon is warning against in these verses, especially in these opening verses, is the aspect of rash generosity. Consider these words, also from Proverbs. Proverbs 11, verse 15. "Whoever puts up security for a stranger will surely suffer harm, but he who hates striking hands in pledge is secure." He'll go on to say in Proverbs 22, verse 7, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender." So Solomon gives us a very clear context as to how this lending and borrowing should happen. If it's in the context of a stranger or a foreigner who we don't know well, Solomon is almost warning us that you do this at your own loss. You do this at your own peril. Let's move on to our section in verse 3 and 4 as we see Solomon's solution. Solomon's solution. He says there, "Then do this, my son, and save yourself, for you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go, hasten, and plead urgently with your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber." Solomon, having explained the scenario, now moves to providing a solution to his son. When the son realizes the potential error of his way, he must do all he can to free himself from being bound to this commitment, but at the same time realize that he is at the mercy of the creditor. He urges his son to save himself, which also can be interpreted, deliver yourself. This is something the son has to do. And as mentioned earlier, the only hope that the son would have in a situation like this is that the creditor is somebody that he knows, maybe has a relationship with, and maybe that friendship would speak well into resolving this commitment. The New King James Version has a slightly different translation on the second half of the verse, of verse 3, where it says there, "Go, hasten, and plead urgently with your neighbor." The New King James Version says this, "Go and humble yourself, plead with your friend." And that really helps to give us a contrast in responses if we look at that translation. Go humble yourself. To humble yourself means to stamp yourself down or to make yourself low. But where the contrast comes in is Solomon says to his son, plead with your friend. This is something that takes great boldness. This is something that he has to take in hand, and he has to go to this creditor and find some way of freeing himself from this binding commitment. The call to action then continues in verse 4. He says, "Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber." This is not a matter that he can afford to be lazy over. He cannot wait. He must act now. There is no room for procrastination. His response cannot be, "Well, I'll get to it tomorrow," or "Maybe if I happen to run into this person, I'll speak to him about this." No. The call is that he must realize that he is in a desperate state and that this commitment places him in a state where he cannot hesitate. It must be done without delay. He's really calling his son to expend whatever energy he has to free himself from this commitment. This brings us then to verse 5. It says, "Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler." This word "hand" features a couple times in our reading, and what you may not have realized, but what we read in Proverbs 11, verse 15 earlier, if you look with me back at verse 1 where it says, "You have given your pledge for a stranger," other translations might use the word to strike the hand. And that simply refers to an Old Testament practice in the days of Solomon where an agreement would be reached by the two parties simply shaking hands. There was no legal document. There was no signing on the bottom line. Everything was summed up in a handshake. But we also see the use of the word "hand" later down in our passage. We see in verse 3 how the swearing of surety for a stranger's loan can place him in the hand of the creditor. And now in verse 5, Solomon gives two further metaphors to describe the state of the son as being in the hand of the hunter or in the hand of the fowler. And so as we consider poetry, and I must say I had some trepidation in preaching this passage because poetry was never a strong point of mine in school. And so it's always difficult to put all these pieces together. But there are some very clear trains of thought that we see in Solomon's writings here. And so there's a progression in this poem through the picture of hands. What started off as a handshake of surety, a handshake of guaranteeing this loan, turns into being in submission to the hand of the creditor, And now in verse 5, it leads to being a life enslaved or captured by the burden of this debt. We must also consider that in Solomon's day, the co-signer of a loan who could not pay what he had signed surety for could lose everything he had. He could even be sold into slavery to repay the debt. Many people today are enslaved to their debt. I found it interesting to read that there's not a single country in the world today that is not in debt. In fact, the global debt index as of the middle of 2019 was estimated at $250 trillion. Now, I mean, I can't fathom that. It just doesn't make sense as to how the world still carries on. But that is the state of debt, and that is the state to which people are living in debt in this life. There is another theme that we can see across these verses, and that is this disposition of being trapped. He says there in verse 2, if you are snared in your words, he also talks about being caught in the words of your mouth. And here in verse 5, he says that you are in the hands of the hunter, you are in the hand of the fowler. And so there's a real sense where this debt can make a person feel enslaved, trapped, under the terrible burden and weight of this commitment. Now, you might be here tonight as a visitor or maybe as a regular church attendee here at BBC, but you do not have a personal relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. If I just ended the service here after having reviewed these verses, you might leave here tonight having heard some wise counsel from Solomon regarding financial commitments and some of the warnings that we are to be aware of as we enter into these commitments. And as sound as that counsel is, that wouldn't change your eternal state in Christ. Your immediate problem is not the problem that Solomon is warning his son about here. Your immediate problem is much deeper than financial debt. Your greatest problem is that you have a debt of sin that you cannot pay or ever hope to pay. No person is able to pay this debt on your behalf. There is no human that is going to stand on a side of you and take that debt on your behalf. Notice, no human. There is only one man, the God-man, the perfect, sinless Son of God, Jesus Christ, who has paid that price fully for all that the Father has given to him. If you refuse his gift of salvation, you will be like this gazelle in the hand of a hunter, or this bird in the hand of the fowler. Solomon doesn't need to go further with that analogy to tell us what the end result is of those two animals. The hunter doesn't catch the gazelle to keep it as a pet and to look after it, nor does the fowler catch the bird to just have it as a nice pet in his living room, singing away through the day. The end of those animals is to be slain and to be eaten, to be consumed. And so it is with debt, and so it is with sin to the unbeliever. Sin will consume you unless you humble yourself under the mighty hand of God who is able to save. Hear these words from Colossians 1, verse 13 and 14. And you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses. Listen to this. By canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands, this he set aside, nailing it to the cross. And so as Doug spoke to us this morning about so near yet so far, don't delay. Don't leave this decision for another day. Call out to God right now. He is mighty to save. What about you, believer? Maybe you're sitting here tonight and you're in the same position. You think, well, those are helpful words. That's a helpful warning about unwise commitments in matters of financial areas. I don't know if you're carrying a burden of financial debt as